From WNPR, I'm John Dankosky, and this is The Wheelhouse.
A local Republican Party office in ashes today after what authorities in one North Carolina town say was a firebombing.
Donald Trump is accusing the, quote, Clinton machine and the media of a conspiracy to keep him out of the White House. The latest CBS News battleground tracker shows Hillary Clinton now has a six-point lead, 46-40% across 13 battleground states.
They were kind of a boy talk, and he was lead on, like egg on, from the host to say dirty and bad stuff.
Four of those women are here tonight, four of them.
Wait, I'm sorry, who's here? Mistresses? Bill, how could you? How will I go on with the debate? No, I'll never be able to remember my facts and figures now. Oh, Donald, no! Get real, I'm made of steel, this is nothing. Hi, girls.
Some of the week's news out of context here to start the Wheelhouse. Join the conversation, 860-275-7266. Comment on our website, WNPR.org/The Wheelhouse. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at WNPR Wheelhouse. We're going to start this program, as always, with Colin McEnroe, host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Good to see you once again, Colin.
To paraphrase Samuel Johnson, he who is tired of Kate McKinnon is tired of life.
Also here, I'm sure we'll talk more about Kate today. Also here with us is Dan Haar. He reports on all sorts of stuff for the Hartford Courant, and he's a columnist there. Hi there, Danny. Good to see you once again.
Great to see you.
And Leah Wright Regur is joining us today from Harvard University. She's, of course, an assistant professor of public policy at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. She often joins us right here in the studio because she's a Hartford native, but she's at work today up at Harvard. So, Leah, so good to have you with us today.
It is always good to be on the show. Thanks, John.
Okay, so first of all, we're going to talk about some of the big news of the week as we head into this debate tonight. And I guess, Colin, the thing that we're probably talking about the most is this repeated claim that Donald Trump has that the election is being stacked against him, actually using the word rigged over and over again, being rigged by the media and the political establishment. He tweeted out the election is absolutely being rigged by the dishonest and distorted media pushing crooked Hillary, but also at many polling places. It's sad, he writes. President Obama, of course, responded to Trump's claims of a rigged election, saying that, well, he should stop whining.
Keep in mind, elections are run by state and local officials, which means that there are places like Florida, for example, where you've got a Republican governor who's a Republican appointees are going to be running and monitoring a whole bunch of these election sites. The notion that somehow if Mr. Trump loses Florida, it's because of those people that you have to watch out for, that is both irresponsible and, by the way, doesn't really show the kind of leadership and toughness that you'd want out of a president.
All right, Colin. So there's a lot of different ways to read this. I mean, we've been hearing Donald Trump say something about the system being rigged for a very long time. Is it different when he's talking now so close to an election that it seems likely that he will lose, looking at the numbers, that he's saying that the actual process of voting is rigged?
Before I answer that, it's possible that President Obama, as he nears the end of his term, he's like Dave in 2001. He's starting to slow down more and more. That took like a minute and a half.
It just took
to say two sentences. I'm concerned about him. I don't know what's going on there. But so, yeah, so rigged is a word that Donald Trump has been using for years. One of my students at Trinity noted that I think he claimed the Emmys were rigged when The Apprentice didn't win. This is also not a new kind of claim. It is circulated around. People forget that in 2008, John McCain felt as though the elections were going to be rigged. I think he thought Acorn was going to rig them or something like that. So, I mean, these are – and in 2004, there were concerns among Democrats that Diebold in particular was somehow or other cranking its voting machines in a way that would ensure George W. Bush a victory in Ohio. So that's not new rhetoric, you know, in politics in general. And claiming things are rigged is not new rhetoric for Donald Trump. But what is new is, yes, this close to the election where he is really – not simply saying that, but really encouraging his supporters to show up. They are interpreting that. The Boston Globe had a chilling story about some of his supporters sort of trying to, you know, process that mandate and how they one guy said, I'm going to engage in racial profiling. I'm going to show up and look for Muslims and Latinos or whatever. There's a piece on NPR today that a lot of places have covered this question. In open carry states, what happens when people show up, you know, wearing sidearms and you know, maybe eyeing Latino voters? All of this operates within the circumference of a consent decree against the Republican National Committee, which bears an unusual burden in terms of what activities it can and can't do in high minority polling districts. And none of this can be done in the name of the RNC, or they will face prosecution by the Justice Department. Let me just say one last thing about this. One thing that Donald Trump has done is impugn all sources of authority, right? The press is part of the rigging. The government's part of the rigging. Obama's point is that I counted yesterday, I think 29 secretaries of state are Republicans. Over 30 governors, I think, are Republicans. But if you impugn all sources of authority, you've got nowhere to go when there's a dispute, right? If the Justice Department intervenes in one of these polling places, well, I mean, he's put that big rigged umbrella up over everything, and it casts a shadow on anything he doesn't like. And it makes it very hard to resolve disputes.
And there probably will be disputes. I'll just quickly read from that quote that Colin had mentioned. Steve Webb, a 61-year-old carpenter from Fairfield, Ohio, this is the quote that he gave the Boston Globe here. "I'll look for, well, it's called racial profiling, Mexicans, Syrians, people who can't speak American," he said. "I'm going to go up right behind them. I'll do everything legally. I want to see if they are accountable. I'm not going to do anything illegal. I'm going to make them a bit nervous." So, Leah, how concerned should we be about this? I mean, this is rhetoric that we've heard on some level for a very long time from Donald Trump. As Colin said, you know, he's talked about the Emmys being rigged. It's not like this is new language, but are we hearing something different from some of his supporters?
Absolutely. And just, you know, to go on record, voter intimidation, standing behind somebody in line and, you know, intimidating them with the intent to discourage them from voting is illegal. It's highly illegal. But I think part of what is going on is that Donald Trump is trying to invalidate the results of the election before they happen, right? So he's setting the case, he's setting the boundaries. And this is, we should all be very, very troubled by this. I don't necessarily think that, you know, every single polling precinct is going to erupt into violence, but the potential for it is there. And not only that, we should be highly concerned that the places that he continues to call out in his speeches time after time tend to be areas that are heavily minority areas, right? And, you know, in his last speech, he mentioned St. Louis, Philadelphia, Chicago. He said we should watch Chicago very, very carefully, very carefully. And it's really setting out to suggest that voting's in these areas, right, these heavily racial minority areas is invalid and is fraught with fraud, when that's not the case, right? So we've done all of these assessments of voting over the past, over the past years, and found that voting fraud is very, very rare. And when it does happen, it's often caught before, right, it has an effect. So one wonders really what he's doing here, and the suggestion is that he's invalidating areas, and that has a very that kind of rhetoric has a very old history. What is different, I think, is the way in which his supporters are interpreting it, and that's important.
Leah, before I go to Dan Haar on this, I just want to not push back on something, but actually bring up something that came up in one of two political forums that I hosted last night at Central Connecticut State University. One of them was a mock debate between J.R. Romano, who heads up the Republican Party here, and Matt Lesser, who's a state lawmaker. And I asked about this question, and I think what I heard J.R. Romano said is, yeah, sure, there's all sorts of potentials, but there's a potential for voter fraud as well. I mean, when you talk about a potential for violence at the polls, there are an awful lot of Republicans, mostly people who support Donald Trump, who say, well, we haven't maybe seen large-scale voter fraud in America, but there's an opening for it. There's a potential for it. What do you say?
So that's why you have officials who work for both campaigns, and that's long been deployed, right? So Republicans and Democrats have sent officials in official capacity who work through official channels to ensure that voter fraud doesn't happen, right? We've seen that there's been a number of coverage over the past couple of months from Republicans and Democrats suggesting, you know, this doesn't happen, and this is what my job entails. So I think to suggest that voter fraud is happening or has the potential to happen is one that is troubling. But what's even more troubling about that is the idea that it only happens in these specific places that tend to be heavily racialized. So why aren't we attacking voter fraud, the potential for voting fraud, in heavily Republican districts? Why aren't we attacking the potential for voting fraud in areas that are heavily white and affluent? Why is it that we are focusing on areas that tend to be heavily minority, heavily low income, and impoverished areas and low income areas?
Danny?
Well, just to pick up on what Leah was saying, that report, correct me if I'm wrong, I believe said there had been 11 cited cases of on-site voter fraud in something like 14 election cycles, totaling a billion votes. So clearly we know that the only voter fraud happening is that people aren't voting. And fraud happens when people are prevented from being able to register and show up and vote. The fraud, such as it is in the absence of the ability to vote, not extra voting. Nobody's voting twice. I think we should welcome that if people would go to the trouble. If I should register in Philadelphia and Connecticut and take the trouble to drive 4.5 hours to vote twice, God bless me. That's not the problem here, and that's not what's happening. What happened in Ohio in 2004, where there were very long lines in Columbus and to a lesser extent in Cleveland, known Democratic strongholds that in some cases were 10 and 11 hours preventing an estimated 129,000 people from voting. That's voter fraud, but it's not the sort that one stands behind a voter to intimidate. And so clearly we're only talking here about intimidation.
You know, in Connecticut, Danny, we've for years now had instances where one town or city has had a problem getting enough ballots out. And so we watch pretty closely what's happening at the polling places. And our Election Day coverage always includes, you know, does Bridgeport have enough ballots? Are the lines too long in Hartford? And of course, this is something that goes on a lot. Do you foresee a nationwide look at what's happening at polling places in a way that we've never seen before, that we actually really have to look at how long are the lines, how easy is it to vote, how many people are standing outside, keeping people from getting in, all of these things? I mean, I don't remember this happening before.
Had to bring up Bridgeport. We knew it was going to be. So it wasn't going to be long. Yeah, you know, look, to some extent, what this trope about voter fraud by Donald Trump has a bright side, which you've just mentioned, and that is it's not a bad idea for us broadly to take a look at how voting is done. There's no excuse for most of the dundlehead stuff that happens, like happened in Bridgeport in 2010 and Hartford in 2014. But it happens, and these are human systems run by humans who unfortunately are partisan and makes it all the more suspect. That's not what we're talking about with the trope, though.
I like the word dundlehead, by the way. Quickly, Colin, on this?
You know, there's a lot of this that kind of devolves into almost folklore. And right now, by the way, I'm encountering people on Facebook, one particularly strident person who believes that Hillary Clinton stole the primaries from Bernie, and she's aware of some website that seems to be very sketchy that's going to file lawsuits in 18 different states about this. And there is the way that there is with the what there was with the Kennedys. There's this notion that the Clintons in particular have this, you know, almost magical ability to steal votes somehow. So that's another thing that's going along with this. This is all going on against the backdrop of an election that is slipping away from Donald Trump really significantly. And it's starting to happen in red states, too. The race, she is closer to him in Texas than he is to her in Pennsylvania right now. Places like Texas and Georgia that should be gimmies, that should be layups, and probably will be ultimately Trump victory states, are now closely fought. So as he's arguing this whole thing out, he's arguing it. The backdrop behind him says, you haven't got a prayer. You're going to get blown out really badly.
Well, and that goes with some of the odd spin that we're hearing coming out of the campaign. You know, Kellyanne Conway, who's running Trump's campaign, says she has so many advantages. She's got endless money, all this media. She has a very popular president and first lady campaigning for her. I'll tell you, I'm mystified as to why she can't get those 52-53% numbers in some of these states. Colin, it's such an odd way to go about it. On one hand, the candidate is essentially throwing in the towel before the election's over, and his campaign seems to be as well.
Yeah, I don't think I've ever heard a campaign manager advance that particular argument, you know, that really we should be losing by much more than we are. But yeah.
Yeah, well, you know, we've talked about this. We're in a situation where any unindicted Democrat would have absolutely trounced Trump, and any of the 16, with the possible exception of Carly Fiorina, who ran against Trump in the primaries, would have trounced Clinton, especially the ones later in the game, Rubio and Kasich. And so, you know, we know that. We have that. The election here is over. We're essentially analyzing. We may as well be speaking on November 9th. The election is over. There is, as the Washington Post put it yesterday, there is no path to victory for Trump.
Leah?
So what I was going to say is that I think part of what is emerging right now, and I think, you know, it's clear that this is the last campaign of a dying campaign, though, is that we're in post-fact America. Right. So facts all of a sudden are now subjective. And I think one of the things that you're seeing coming out as part of this language of invalidating the election results and casting doubt on the election results is this idea that we have our own set of facts. We have our own set of polls. We have our own set of ideas. So therefore, anything that disagrees with our outlook and our perspective is discredited. And I think we're going to continue to see this right up until the day of the election and quite possibly the day after an election and maybe the weeks after the election.
You call it post-fact America. I prefer post-Fakistan, which has a very nice ring to it. Quickly, let's go to Peter from Meriden. Hi, Peter. What's on your mind?
Hey, I wanted to talk about the fact I don't think it's quite rigging, like Donald Trump says. But I've noticed a very defined media bias that goes further than just the op-ed pieces that have been highly featured in the New York Times, the Washington Post, and USA Today. However, even in the way that they will phrase things, for example, if there's protesters at a Trump event, they call it Trump protesters. But on the parallel, if there's someone protesting at a Hillary event, they'll call it a Trump supporter disrupting the event. So it seems to filter down to every way that they even put any terms onto the discussion. And it seems a little unfair how highly featured all these op-ed pieces have been in the past 3 or 4 weeks.
Peter, thank you very much for that. I will say, Danny, this came up in our panel discussions that we were having last night. I mean, the fact is that whether or not you're going to call it rigged or not, there are an awful lot of Trump supporters, and there are an awful lot of Republicans who don't support Donald Trump who look at the way the media is covering this and say, well, there is a little bit more selectivity of the way we're doing things. Another way to look at it is some of the things Donald Trump has said have been so egregious and outside the lines of what we normally see from a presidential candidate that there's more attention paid and more fact-checking. I mean, what do you say to Peter and Meriden?
Well, I think he has a point, and I think that if rigged— Look, rigged means two different things, many different things, but two of the things it means here is crooked, and another thing is favorite. There's favoritism. And what Donald Trump is doing is he's merging the two purposefully to suit his needs. And what I would say is that if what he's saying is that there is biased favoritism against him, I would say deal me in. Yes, there is on the part of the media. And the reason is because the media, as with other institutions in this country, is correctly programmed to filter out anti-intellectualism, hucksterism, the aggrandizement of sexual aggression, and a number of other things that we damn well should be filtering out.
And I have so many things to say about this. I guess one thing that I would say to Peter is imagine a campaign where somebody you really admire, let's say it's Ronald Reagan, is running against David Duke. Would you expect us to cover this in a symmetrical way? In other words, every time David Duke does something, we should go and find something that Ronald Reagan has done and criticize that equally. Should we use the same kind of language about Ronald Reagan that we use about David Duke? Now, you know, when you do it in such an extreme contrast, I think the answer is no, you don't do that. And to many journalists, this is not that dissimilar. It's not a symmetrical campaign. It doesn't call for symmetrical coverage. And really, for Trump to complain about the media leaning one way or another is a little bit like, you know, Eric and Lyle Menendez asking for mercy because they're orphans. I mean, he created this environment. He benefited tremendously from a certain kind of free media coverage in the early stages. He then declared war on the press very early. And that now he floods. I mean, the main reason that he's getting the kind of coverage that he's getting right now is he floods the zone with all these crazy tweets and outlandish statements. And so the media is guilty of covering him in a negative way because they just write down what he says.
30 seconds, Leah?
Yeah. So I was going to say exactly that. This is the candidate who has gotten more free publicity from the media than any other candidate in this election cycle, any primary contender. If we want to talk about media bias, I think that we should look at the campaigns of those people who didn't get coverage, right? So analysis has shown that Bernie Sanders, for example, didn't get the same amount of coverage. The other thing is that, you know, it would be a lot easier to talk about both candidates, and I don't want to make false equivalencies, but it would be easier to talk about both candidates if Donald Trump didn't continue to try and dominate the conversation. And so anytime there is an opening, he goes and does something that he knows is going to generate attention, massive publicity and attention, whether it be of the positive or negative kind. That makes it very, very difficult to have a conversation about the election in sum.
Leah Wright-Rigueur is Assistant Professor of Public Policy at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. Dan Haar is a columnist for the Hartford Courant. Colin McEnroe, hosts the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. We'll be right back in the wheelhouse to talk about what we're going to see in tonight's debate. That's next. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. We're joined today by Leah Wright-Regur. She is an assistant professor of public policy at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. She joins us from Harvard today. Dan Haar is here. He writes for the Hartford Current, and our own Colin McEnroe. Colin, what's on your show today at 1 o'clock?
We're going to talk about Laura Ingalls Wilder, the Little House on the Prairie author, although she may not actually have written the books, her daughter may have. But she also she's become kind of a libertarian heroine. So we're going to talk about sort of the politics that have been foisted onto Little House on the Prairie. And, John, I know we're about to start talking about the debate.
Yeah.
I think it's important to have our debate theme music. Kyone, could we have our debate theme music?
Viva!
It's funny, too, because didn't it all start in Las Vegas, Colin? I mean, I think that the first Democratic debate was actually in a Vegas casino, and we at the time thought, oh, my goodness, is this where we're going?
Yeah, Telly Savalas was the moderator of that one, too. So.
Yeah, you know, it was kind of a while ago. So, Lee, I mean, what do we expect for tonight? I mean, there's so many, like, side plots and subplots and strange things that have never happened before during a presidential campaign, and now here we are, and it's like the Super Bowl of presidential debates, but only it's like the Super Bowl and the Cirque du Soleil all tied up in one. I mean, what do we expect?
This is the WWE, and that is what Trump has brought to the presidential arena. And we know that he is bringing as his guest, he has a lineup of surprise guests, including Barack Obama's half-brother and one of the Benghazi mothers. And he says he has lots more lined up. Now, Hillary has her own guests, including Mark Cuban. But I think that's a different arena, and it's also hard to tell which Donald Trump we're going to get tonight. It seems like we're going to get riled up, angry, intense Donald Trump, who's going to cater to his base and say the things that energize his base, and that we're not going to get. I'm not sure if this exists, but we're not going to get thoughtful Trump or Trump who is thinking about policy and thinking about, you know, the nation as a whole. So I think prepare for the spectacle, prepare for the drama. And, you know, this man knows how to generate ratings. It's like VH1 celeb reality right now.
It's funny, Danny, because, you know, Mark Cuban supporting Hillary Clinton. Now, Mark Cuban's like the annoying guy at the NBA game in the front row until you realize he actually owns the team. That's a little different than some of the guests that Donald Trump is bringing along.
Yes and no. Yesterday, last night on CNN, Mark Cuban did announce that he has two friends, people he knows. One was directly and one was a friend of a friend who claimed to be victims of Donald Trump's sexual aggression, and he says he personally, Mark Cuban, has vetted this. So really sports, reality shows, politics, it's all merging into one.
Yeah, but Mark Cuban has vetted this.
That's a serious charge.
Well, of course it's a serious charge, but one problem with this entire campaign is that there's serious charges, there's not serious charges. We don't know what's serious is and what isn't. We don't know what comes from a reality TV show, and we don't know what was staged. We have no idea at all what's happening. We have a press conference with accusers of Bill Clinton just before a presidential debate, and then we have accusers come out accusing Donald Trump, who he says shouldn't be listened to.
And the writers at Saturday Night Live almost can't outdo the reality.
Oh, no, and Saturday Night Live isn't actually all that funny anymore, Colin. I can't laugh at it.
That's right. So Donald Trump said months after guest hosting it. I think one of the questions I have about tonight is, can any signal get through all this noise? Can we actually hear anything from either of these candidates that's actually meaningful in terms of maybe how they would govern, something along those lines? I think that's unlikely. The other thing is, I have this hope. I was sort of disabused of this hope by my class at Trinity last night, that somebody could get to Trump, somebody that he will listen to, somebody that he respects. I have no idea who that person is, mind you. And get him to say something a little bit more conciliatory than he did in the last debate. If you may recall, it took Anderson Cooper, I think, four tries to get Trump to say yes, he would accept the results of the election. And he did it as kind of a throwaway, you know, in the middle of some other rant he was doing. I think it's just so important that tonight he say that in a more heartfelt way. I know I'm just dreaming here, but if he could at some point just say, look, this is a great country. We have to respect the process and the democracy. I'm very unhappy about certain things. I've made those things very clear. But at the end, because, you know, when you think about the speech that Al Gore had to make in 2000, you know, without that speech, we probably have a very different country, at least in the initial days of that administration. You know, and Trump, at some point or other, is either going to have to make that speech or not make it in a way that really cripples our ability to believe in our government. I would love to see him set the stage for that tonight. I realize, as Leah's chuckle is indicating, that I'm crazy even to think that that might happen.
Very quick thought on this, Leah?
Yeah, so I think that generally Trump's campaign speeches are an indication of where he's going to go. And if this is any indication, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if he shows up with Hillary Clinton's email server, because that is, you know, as his guest, that's where he is right now. And I think one of the things, you know, that we really have to talk about is, you know, what is Trump trying to do? And one of the things that he's trying to do is not just burn, say, the Democratic Party and Hillary Clinton down, but he's trying to burn the Republican Party down. Right. So this is part of, you know, this is part of this spectacle. This is part of this, you know, from the ashes, something will rise. And I think that's the Trump that we're going to get tonight.
Yeah. Of course, Leah mentioned earlier, Colin, that Trump plans to have Obama's estranged brother as a guest. Sounds a little bit more like The Godfather. Father Part 2 than anything that we've normally seen. But he's got another special guest coming tonight, doesn't he?
Well, Wayne Newton has been invited, I mean, by Donald Trump. And I don't know. I mean, I'm obviously very down on Donald Trump right now. I always think Wayne Newton is like the worst example of a Las Vegas entertainer. But there you go.
Well, as we head to break, maybe we'll listen to a little bit of Wayne Newton. And I'll ask you to pledge in support of programs just like this. When we talk about politics here on WNPR, it's with you in mind, the idea that you want to hear about this stuff. So here are some colleagues of ours who are going to tell you how you can become a member and support WNPR, The Wheelhouse, and all the other great stuff that you hear. Don't go away. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky, joined today by Colin McEnroe, who hosts, of course, The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Dan Haar of the Hartford Current, Leah Wright-Rigueur from Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. Got a lot more to get to on this very busy week of news. Of course, the most recent trove of Hillary Clinton emails released by WikiLeaks are from her campaign chair, John Podesta. CNN says they reveal a buttoned-up campaign that analyzes nearly every decision, mirroring Clinton's reputation as a methodical and tactical politician. Secret transcripts of her paid speeches behind closed doors on Wall Street have failed to turn up any positions widely different than what she says in public. Colin, as we just look through everything that has been leaked out in the various ways it has, I mean, do we see smoking guns here? Do we see things that are much different than the Hillary Clinton we really expected to see when these emails came out?
Yeah, there tend to be two kinds of problems when things like this happen. Either they completely contravene the image that you've set up for yourself, they violate the public's reasonable expectations about you, or they confirm the public's expectations about you. I think these tend to do the latter. I haven't seen anything with a real wow factor. I know that's going to sound like I'm in the tank, but I mean, there's things in there that would be disturbing and probably would cause trouble in a, quote, normal, unquote, campaign, which this is not. For all the reasons we talked about earlier, Trump is kind of flooded the zone with an awful lot of stuff that makes it very hard to kind of part all that smoke and look at the Clinton gun. I just, you know, a lot of this stuff also is attributable to staffers as opposed to Clinton. There's that one thing where she talks in one of her speeches about the public policy versus the private policy. She had to deal with that in the last debate. I don't know. I mean, I'm not saying there's no there, but there isn't a really big capital T-H-E-R-E there.
So maybe not a big there out of those leaks, Dan, but, you know, from the FBI's year-long investigation into Clinton sending and receiving these government secrets via this unauthorized server. This comes from The Guardian. Patrick Kennedy, a senior U.S. State Department official, sought to shield Hillary Clinton by pressuring the FBI to drop its insistence that an email on the private server she used while Secretary of State contained classified information, that essentially she's throwing her weight around. Is this something that we're expecting to see? Is it more than we expected to see?
Well, I think that this is, you know, in somewhat points to a problem. Incriminating is maybe too strong a word. It's, you know, by the way, it's not that Patrick Kennedy. This is a Patrick Kennedy who served under both Republican and Democratic administrations.
Yes.
He's an undersecretary, but he's not a political appointee. He's a career staffer, a very high-ranking staffer.
He does have that last name, though.
Yes,
but
he does, and the first name for Rhode Island. If it turns out that there's been any communication prior to that between Hillary Clinton and Patrick Kennedy, then you know you have a really serious issue. The other question is that people do protect their boss, and that's not right, and that can turn around on Hillary Clinton. So I would say that we want to make sure that this conversation is not rigged. I would go a step further than Colin went and say that I think that is something very serious, and I would put it as a mark against Clinton.
Although we have to say one thing about that, which is whatever that was, whatever was being talked about in terms of the quid pro quo, the one thing we do know is that it didn't happen. In other words, ultimately both sides dropped that idea. It was not pursued. Whatever that was that they were talking about, it is a thing that never happened.
An expression of power, but not actually a use of power. Leah, what do you say?
So one thing that I will say, and I agree, I completely agree with this idea that, you know, anything that we might pull out of these emails has really just Donald Trump has managed to overshadow all of that. But there were a couple of interesting things that came out of, I believe it was the Podesta emails, and then also some of the leaked transcripts or speeches. And two things I want to point out. The one that leaves me, I think. That leaves me a little uncomfortable was the statement about the always do wells and the never do wells, where it seems like it wasn't Hillary Clinton, but people on her team are dividing groups into kind of these categories as a way kind of way to classify them. And then the other thing that I thought was really fascinating was the transcript from the Black Lives Matter, the meeting with Black Lives Matter activists that show, I think, some of the fractures, the very real fractures between the Democratic Party and some of its, formerly reliable constituent groups. And it has implications not necessarily for right now, but for immediately following the election, right, as people begin to try and push and try and get policy passed. And so we saw some of these issues, this headbutting over issues like mass incarceration, police reform, police accountability, where we saw a lot of the cautious Hillary that we've come to know throughout this campaign really butting heads with some of these more radical activists.
Well, and I think it points, Leah, to something we've said over and over again, not just today, but over the course of months, is that maybe against a different Republican candidate, these are exactly the sorts of fractures that would have caused massive problems for a Hillary Clinton campaign.
Right. And so, you know, in other years, I think, you're talking about, oh, are we going to have a low turnout? A lot of people are not necessarily motivated by Hillary Clinton in the way that they were motivated by Barack Obama. And she is running against the Republican Party selected perhaps the worst person, you know, in terms of generating interest either in the Republican Party or kind of encouraging low turnout. They nominated someone who people are motivated to turn out against. And so a lot of these issues, a lot of these fractures, I think, are obscured by, you know, the current election cycle. But immediately following that, as we begin to talk about policy, as we begin to talk about the Supreme Court, as we begin to talk again about TPP and things like that, we are going to see many of these issues come up and really be at, you know, be contentious points within the Democratic Party. So the Republican Party is going through a civil war right now. I wouldn't be surprised if the Democratic Party starts going through its own issues immediately following the election.
John, I think we need to address your peculiar silence over the email exchange in which Huma Abedin and another Clinton staffer did not know who Dave Brubeck was. and there's a conversation that they go back and forth about where to seat Dave Brubeck. And finally, the guy says, okay, I give up. Who's Dave Brubeck? And Huma Abedin writes, I don't know, some singer guy that WJC likes.
I never saw that one. Oh, my God, I'm so upset.
Reason
now.
Enough to go vote for Jill Stein if you're John Dankosky, I think.
I will. Or I'm going to write in Dave Brubeck, for God's sakes, and he's been dead for a couple of years. I just want to say, on a normal wheelhouse, the thing that would be most fun out of this is Chris Murphy is a possible vice presidential candidate?
Well, yeah, I mean, that is sort of good for a giggle, except that I think Chris Murphy is a very viable national politician. No, look at Danny over there.
He's shaking his head.
certainly, you haven't heard the last of Chris Murphy. He turns up on this list.
I would think not.
Is it like food groups or something? Was he white bread or something? So anyway, he turned up on the white bread list. But, you know, he's not going away. And you'll be 4 years from now, we'll be having a different conversation about it.
John Podesta knows very well Chris Murphy is a great person to put on a list. Chris Murphy is a wonderful legislator, a great thinker, very even-handed. He's a terrific.
Equine? I don't
not equine. The problem with Chris Murphy is he's been a professional legislator since age 23. That's not enough in today's politics to move to the next level. He needs to get out and run for governor in the next cycle and be the governor of Connecticut or run a nonprofit or a university. He has to run something. He's not going to accede to the next level without doing so.
Danny taking Chris Murphy out of the horse race, as it were. Leah, quick thought on Chris Murphy?
Well, you know, I think what Hillary did with that list, or what John Podesta did with that list, was set up and showcase, you know, what the Democratic bench looks like. That was a really, really long list. But I think it's important that, you know, Chris Murphy was on there. It means that the Democratic Party sees him as a star. They see him as somebody who has reach and who has appeal. And, you know, that should really make the people of Connecticut feel good.
But before we run out of time, Leah, I want you to talk about a panel that you moderated recently at Harvard. It was about the President Obama legacy. I mean, yes, of course, we still got months left of the President Obama presidency, and there's so much more to happen between now and then. But even in some of the speeches that he's been giving recently, the way he's been talking on the campaign trail, this has been a little bit different President Obama than we maybe saw for the first 7 years or so. I mean, what do you make of the Obama legacy this far in?
So, you know, I'm a historian by training, and historians are notoriously gun-shy about about projecting on legacies this early out. But I do think it's important that we think about this, you know, especially within the context of a historic 8 years, right? The nation's first black president, and the way in which he was received, the policies that he passed, and the way in which he engaged with the nation. I think one of the things that came out is that there was no clear consensus on his policy legacy. In fact, there was quite a deal of frustration that crossed ideological lines in terms of Barack Obama. There was, however, a discussion about the symbolism, right, of having the nation's first black president in the White House, what it meant. And then, in fact, you know, there was another consensus that even as people couldn't agree about his legacy, that maybe 10 years from now, we may be reevaluating him based on things like bringing health care, right, passing health care in a nation where health care reform seemed all but impossible. So, yeah, it was a fantastic conference, and I think one of the other things that came out of it too was to really talk about the potential of reforms that will come beyond Obama. So thinking about mass incarceration, thinking about police reform, and really thinking about immigration reform in the coming years and how vital that is for our nation.
Colin, quick thought?
I think one of the mysteries is why in this election cycle Obama's record isn't something that a Democrat can run on, why this turned into kind of a change cycle through Bernie Sanders and through Donald Trump. Hillary Clinton did just drop a commercial, which I'm sure will be targeted at African-American voters, but it's about preserving the legacy of Barack Obama. Both Barack and Michelle Obama appear in the commercial, and it's also very much about voting. The first thing you see in the commercial is a vote here sign in a voting place. Then you see people voting. It's meant to address that gap right now that Obama voters are not necessarily going to make the trip to the polls for Hillary Clinton. She's trying to deal with that right now.
Not being trained as a historian, I can say quickly as to his legacy. I believe he's going to be seen as a great, obviously great orator, great emotional leader, strong, consistent policies, but his inability to work with his own Democrats in Congress, as with Dan Malloy's inability to work with Democrats in Hartford, is going to be a lasting problem looking back.
Danny, very quickly, you were mentioning during the break that you're going to be torn between watching John Lackey pitch for the Cubs tonight in this very important game and this presidential debate. Meanwhile, we hear Kurt Schilling planning a Senate run against Elizabeth Warren.
Kurt Schilling is going to make Donald Trump look like Romney.
Colin is a Red Sox fan.
Yeah, I don't know if I want to see that bloody sock on the campaign trail. In his latest interview, he says he needs a very big yes from his wife before he can launch his 2018 bid.
So we're wondering if that yes is coming. We usually end the program with a few notes from the outer sphere, things that people are thinking about that maybe we haven't talked about yet. Leah, you have a quick thought for us?
So just a quick thought. My book is out. My book, The Loneliness of the Black Republican, not a memoir, is out again as second edition. It is the perfect way to make sense not just of the madness of the 2016 election, but also think about party politics and race moving forward beyond 2016.
Yes, we've talked about this book on the air before, The Loneliness of the Black Republican. Danny, what's your thoughts as we close out here?
I was out at Central last night and noticed a poster. There is a Youth for Socialist Action all-day conference at Central on Saturday, 9 to 6 at the Student Center. Unfortunately, the poster has lots of speakers, but no time and place. So maybe that says something about socialism. There was no profit incentive to make that poster. But it would be good to see that sort of thing. I'm not in that camp, but it would be good to see that sort of thinking happening in Connecticut, because we need more of everything in policy.
I will just say I met a young man yesterday, a Central student, who came to my forums that I hosted, and he said, "Man, I'm like a socialist, and my girlfriend's a Trump supporter. I don't know what I'm going to do." Anyway, that was my story from last night, Colin.
One of the sites I visit every 4 years is called livingroomcandidate.org. It warehouses TV campaign commercials dating back to the birth of television. So you see these animated Eisenhower commercials and stuff like that. They're featuring right now Confessions of a Republican, a four-minute ad from the 1964 cycle featuring an actor named Bill Bogert just talking directly to camera. It's an amazing ad. You watch it, and then you have to sort of hunt for it. He's 80 years old now. He's still alive. He made an ad. He made basically the same ad for Hillary Clinton. Many of the things he says about Goldwater in this ad, he can very easily say about Trump.
And Leah, I'm going to bring you in for my outer sphere thing, a thing we didn't get a chance to talk about. The president of one of the largest police organizations in the United States on Monday apologized for historical mistreatment of minorities, calling it, quote, a dark side of our shared history that must be acknowledged and overcome. How taken were you by what we heard from the International Association of Chiefs of Police president?
I was shocked. I think it's a huge step forward. It is, you know, especially within this political climate, that is a massive thing. That kind of, you know, even getting that kind of an apology, or getting to an apology, it's a step. The next step is actually accountability, transparency, and action. So, yeah.
Leah Wright-Rigger, she's an assistant professor of public policy at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. She joined us from Harvard today. Leah, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Danny Haar from the Hartford Current. Thanks as always, Dan. It was good to see you.
Great to be here.
And Colin McEnroe, the host of the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Thanks, Colin.
Thank you.
You can now hear from some of our friends who are going to tell you why you should support The Wheelhouse and all the other great programming right here on WNPR. Thanks so much.